Hello, and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My guest today is David E. Martin, whose work in international finance has put him on the trail of the companies and individuals behind the development of the COVID-19 virus and the vaccinations designed to protect against it, supposedly. This is a pretty dark tale where it's hard to tell what came first, the chicken or the egg. But we can see who the foxes in the hen house are. So buckle up for a strange ride, and here is me talking to David E. Martin. I'm pleased to have David Martin on the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here. Can you tell the listeners what your business actually is and give them an idea of maybe how you got involved in the whole COVID-19 story?
Yeah, well, I'm the chairman and CEO of MCAM. Since 1998, MCAM has been the leading underwriter of intangible assets used in finance, banking, and equities around the world. We're the owners and operators of the leading quantitative equity indexes, the INAU, INAG, and trade war indexes that have been consistently outperforming the classic market indexes since 2015. Our involvement with the entire pandemic charade began in 1999. As most people may know, the patents and the intellectual property for the manipulation of coronavirus started with a number of research projects funded by NIAID in 1999. The first patents resulting from those came out in 2002, but I became aware of what was going on with the use of biological material as a significant influencer of public behavior, obviously in September of 2001 during the anthrax scare, when we got to participate in the work around how to get the treatment for anthrax poisoning, which was ciprofloxacin that was provided by Bayer, how to get that treatment available at a market rate that wasn't extortionary, which is what Bayer was trying to do back in 2001. And it was through that work that I became acutely aware of a number of biological manipulations that crossed, in my estimation, the line of biological weapons research, which, as you know, James, has been outlawed in the United States for many years. And so from 2002 forward, I was reporting on a number of the manipulations of coronavirus to various congressional investigations, to conferences on bioweapons and bioengineering. And so I've been following this thing since 2002 in a formal capacity.
Did Tony Fauci turn the pharmaceutical industry into a monster?
There's no question. He did that probably in somewhere around 1986, where having been at NIAID for 2 years, he saw his role move from being the director of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease, which, as the name implies, is supposed to be focused on preventing allergies and infectious disease. During his tenure and during the $191 billion of taxpayer money that's gone through his fingers, he realized very shortly into the exercise that it would be far better to be the handmaiden of the pharmaceutical companies. And beginning in 1986, he began using biological material as a means to build dependencies on his ultimate panacea, which was, as the public records very clearly state, he saw everything as a vaccine in waiting. His absolute obsession was to vaccinate HIV, to vaccinate coronavirus, to vaccinate influenza. And recently, James, a lot of people don't know this. You would potentially appreciate this from being in the Northeast. His most recent campaign, beginning in earnest in 2017, was to develop a vaccine for opioid addiction, because clearly the solution to opioid addiction is a vaccine for it.
No, I didn't know that. He's become kind of the taxi dispatcher for all of pharmacology. And he, yes. has engineered himself into a position of having a part interest in thousands of patents for both the disease organisms themselves and the inoculations, the vaccines, and gets a split of the royalties with the grant recipients who he directs these federal monies to.
Yeah, and it's quite a convenient position to be, as you pointed out, kind of the taxi dispatcher. His role is to allocate market, which under antitrust laws is a felony, but under NIH implementation apparently is the way we're supposed to transition from a Westphalian nation state economy to a Anthony Fauci postmodern pharma industrial state economy. And what we've got is a situation where he quite literally is picking the winners and losers. And the winners, not surprisingly, are the ones who are willing to take his money in exchange for them advancing his agenda. And his agenda is there is a shot for everyone. And in 2018, 2019, the NIAID council minutes are filled with his ultimate wet dream fantasy, which is to inject children at birth with a universal influenza vaccine, which will get them perpetually addicted to have a multi-pathogen injection on a regular basis to make sure that every child is not left behind.
Hmm. Well, Bobby Kennedy pointed out that since he came on board in 1984, the chronic disease rate in the U.S. has gone from about 12.8% to now 54%. His mission is supposed to be to control chronic disease. It doesn't look like he's done a very good job on that.
If we looked at it from the classic capitalist lens of kind of the Columbia and Harvard business model, we would say that a CEO who has presided over a $191 billion enterprise, who has failed to deliver on a single tangible outcome per the mandate of the corporation, in this case NIAID, one would think that we would have had some sort of shareholder revolt. But instead, what we have is the fawning acquiescence to the near sainthood that the popular media elites have decided to bestow on this benighted grandfather who, in my estimation, is anything but.
Who's protecting him?
Well, it's abundantly clear that he has an enormous amount of protection coming from the pharmaceutical industry itself. But at the end of the day, I have to say that, you know, I'm a big fan of following the money. And the money runs back to BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard and the institutional capital that profits off the back of this. I mean, remember that in 2015, Peter Daszak, who is the very famous veterinarian come coronavirus expert, who was the one that was laundering money to the Chinese in 2015 and 16 through EcoHealth Alliance, made the quote at a National Academy of Sciences meeting that we need to increase public understanding for the need for a pan-coronavirus vaccine. A key driver is the media, and the economics will follow the hype. We need to use that hype to our advantage to get to the real issue. Investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process. Now, I know that I'm just this cunning, inquiring mind, but that feels to me not like a public health statement. It feels to me like a self-serving mercenary who is bent on serving a financial master, because that whole investors will respond if they see profit at the end of the process sounds more monetary than health to me.
Yeah, there's a couple of things here that I find disturbing. I mean, one is the intimation that the entire COVID-19 episode has been some kind of a hoax, which, frankly, I did not believe for the first 12 months of the thing. I thought that there was something real about it. Now I'm not so sure, and I'm wondering about the Joseph Goebbels-like propaganda effort behind it, which has been ramped up to the max now. You know, every other commercial on TV is a public service commercial for getting an injection. So To what extent is this thing some kind of a number that's being run on the America or on the global population?
Well, I have, you know, I've gotten a lot of heat for saying this, but I like to use their own language. I mean, I'm not into assigning some sort of conspiratorial theory to a thing. I mean, when you say a key driver is the media and economics will follow the hype, we need to use that hype to our advantage. And then in February of 2020, that same gentleman on February 6th and February 7th, as we've seen now publicly in Anthony Fauci's email FOIA responses, for the days of February 6th and February 7th, and James, it's important for everybody to understand that this was a month before the World Health Organization's International Committee on the Taxonomy of Viruses, the ICTV, had determined that this was in fact a novel virus. A month earlier, this same Peter Daszak, the same guy who said we need the media to create hype, was frantically trying to conscribe an enormous number of scientists to build a backstory on the fact that this came from a, you know, zoonotic transfer from a bat and a pangolin going in and getting drunk at a bar in Wuhan. Now, the fact of the matter is, if you have the guy who said in 2015, we need this to be a media hype, and then on February 6th and 7th, he is scrambling to cover his own trail by making sure he gets a bunch of scientists to sign off on the fact that this is a product of nature rather than a laboratory exercise, the reason why it stinks is because it stinks.
What year are we talking about here?
So 2015 is when the quote comes from. Mm-hmm. 2016, 17, and 18 is when we know that the spike protein was, quote, poised for human emergence, according to NIAID's own funded research during the moratorium on gain of function, which was, by the way, a recombinant synthetic chimeric alteration of coronavirus that was known and, according to email exchanges that I am in possession of from November of 2019, that spike protein was already delivered to Moderna to begin vaccine development on a vaccine for SARS that in fact hadn't even allegedly emerged until December 20th when the first genome was allegedly uploaded. So a month before there is a pathogen, we're already working on the cure for the pathogen that didn't yet exist.
Well, there's even more monkey business in there with involving the moratorium that Barack Obama set in 2016, I believe. And yet, a Chinese virus was brought to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 2016. And their ethic commission at Chapel Hill somehow overruled the Obama moratorium. And what was Fauci's role in that?
Yeah, well, conveniently, if you were paying attention this spring, we see that his role was to get himself poised to get an honorary doctorate and be the commencement speaker for the UNC Chapel Hill, which was terribly convenient. It's lovely to give an organization several $100 million and then get an honorary doctorate in exchange for that. So well done there. But the fact is that this is a place where Rand Paul fell on his own sword when he had Fauci in testimony, because the fact of the matter is, in 2015, the Wuhan Institute of Virology virus was allegedly, according to the written reports of UNC Chapel Hill, was uploaded to the UNC Chapel Hill BSL-3 lab, which is where Ralph Baric was working. And according to the 2016 publication that said that the coronavirus is poised for human emergence, the footnotes to that particular paper indicate that there were two, not one, but two institutional review boards impaneled, because they not only had to do an institutional review board on the unethical research that they were doing, but they had to impanel a second board to actually review the illegality of violating the moratorium on gain of function. Ironically, when Rand Paul asked Anthony Fauci about that very project, Rand Paul seemed to back away from delivering the knockout blow, which is in his own hand, NIAID had sent UNC Chapel Hill a letter specifically referencing this project and specifically saying that is in violation of the gain of function moratorium, except for a tiny little clause at the last paragraph on the first page of the letter, which happened to say, but given that your project is already funded and is ongoing, we'll let you decide if the moratorium applies.
Mm-hmm. Where does Moderna fit into this? They seem to have learned that particular SARS virus was the virus to concentrate their efforts on, but they knew that a good 2-3 years before the outbreak or the supposed outbreak. And in fact, can we just step back for a minute? And I have to ask you this question. To what extent was it actually an outbreak?
And
to what extent was it just the coronaviruses that come around every year?
Well, here's the funny thing. You know, just recently it was politically and from the media standpoint, it's now fair game to talk about an outbreak from the Chinese laboratory. The problem is that that is also itself a distraction and a cover story, because the fact of the matter is we know that the sequences for the actual symptomatic, what we call COVID-19, the protein sequences associated with that and the gene sequences associated with those proteins were isolated in Wuhan in 2013. Mm-hmm. That's how we got to the Wuhan Institute of Virology Virus 1, or WIV1. And so the very pathogen that allegedly was being studied at UNC Chapel Hill in 2015 was supposedly isolated from miners of bat guano in 2013.
But this thing has been swapped back and forth for years.
Oh, yeah. And the crazy thing is the idea of this nonsensical story of there is an outbreak of a pathogen is great for Hollywood movies that need to be buttoned up in 2 hours, where you've got some sort of nefarious actor, you know, who's out there trying to destroy the world. But the fact is that we know that there has been circulating forms of coronavirus and circulating forms of the human manipulated SARS coronavirus since 2002. So the illusion that somehow or another this is a novel pathogen has actually recently in the Lancet been proven to be false, as I've been saying for months, using the patent data I've looked at. There is not a shred of novelty associated with the Wuhan Institute of Virology first uploads that took place between December 20th and January 2nd, December 20th of 2019 and January 2nd of 2020. There has not been any evidence of novelty. And if you go on to any of the public fora that publish gene sequences, you see that the phylogenetic trees only appear to be trees based on the order in which the data is uploaded. A thing doesn't exist just because we start measuring it. It starts being reported because we measure it, but it didn't start in December of 2020. We know that this particular symptom-based response to some form of coronavirus actually started in 2013, and the evidence is absolutely airtight on this. It's important to point out, and we're going to get to Moderna, but it's important to point out that on January 2nd, 2020, so this is supposedly days or weeks after SARS was allegedly starting, the Chinese Academy of Sciences published a paper in the Lancet that stated that they had 41 patients who had PCR confirmed COVID-19 viral infection. James, that's not even possible. You couldn't have had a PCR test for a pathogen that had not yet even been sequenced, which means that 41 laboratory confirmed tests on PCR as of the 2nd of January means that we knew what this pathogen was a long time ago, because they were able to confirm viral fragments by the 2nd of January, which was 3 months before the pathogen was declared novel.
Well, let me just stop you there and ask you a clinical question, because one of the things that you bring into issue is whether it was, in fact, a novelty a novel coronavirus. But the main clinical symptoms of this particular disease is supposed to be that it targets the epithelial lung tissue.
Yeah.
That sounds to me like it's different from, you know, a standard influenza. Is it, or where does that fit in?
Yeah, so in 2015, you know, Ralph Barrick's lab at UNC Chapel Hill were trying to amplify this infectious, what they called replication defective form of coronavirus. So the idea was, how do you target the ACE2 receptor and how do you target the S1 spike protein attachment that happens with coronavirus? How do you target those to amplify their pathogenicity in humans? The problem was, in mice, which is the model that we use most often in biological research, we actually couldn't get the coronavirus to be overly lethal. So they were trying to amplify the effect so it would actually harm human lung tissue more. But the novelty that is claimed in the 2019 virus, if we want to call it a virus, which it isn't, there's already, you know, several hundred variations by the time we get into January and February of 2020. But the idea that this is a novel virus is falsifiable, because in 2015, we know that the attributes that made this allegedly novel were already published, and by 2018, not only published, but patented. So there is no novelty other than another mutation of another computer simulated version of another form of SARS coronavirus. There is no novelty on, you know, December 20th when the first sequence was uploaded, or December 22nd or December 28th or December 30th or January 2nd. None of those things are in fact novel. They are just distinctions based on small genetic alterations where the homology between these things is as high as 99.9%. So the notion that somehow this is novel is absolutely beyond the pale.
But wait a minute. How do we get from an organism or a thing that is targeted at lung tissue to the main part of the clinical story now, which is that it's a, quote, a blood disease, that it now attacks the epithelial linings of the vascular system, the circulatory system, because that was supposedly the new feature of COVID-19.
Well, no, COVID-19 was supposed to start off as a total atypical pneumonia.
Uh-huh.
If you go back and look at what the world...
But isn't it a fact that the focus on it for the last 12 months has been its character as a blood disease?
Yeah. But that's a migration from where we started. And it is, in fact, the spike protein, not the virus. It's the spike protein that we're manipulating that is the thing that's actually creating the blood disorder.
Okay, so we've got the vaccine. To what extent is the spike protein that the vaccine induces, to what extent is that a pathogen and or a toxic agent?
Well, so here comes the part that's probably most alarming, and it's the one that, you know, the fact checkers have been very upset that I say this because it has the inconvenience of being true, and it bothers them greatly that it is, which is the spike protein in the Moderna and the Pfizer injection are not derived from a natural virus. They are a computer simulation of a simulation of the S1 spike protein RNA encoding mechanism. In other words, what you get when you get an RNA injection from Pfizer or from Moderna is you get the RNA code to manufacture a synthetic, chimerically altered computer simulation of the SARS coronavirus S1 spike protein. This is not derived from the natural model. This is hypothecated from a computer simulation of a generalized model.
Yeah, but there's a confusing element to this. To what extent is this a computer phantom, and to what extent is it something that actually dwells in people's bodies?
Well, it's actually some of both. And the problem that we have, and this is why this blood disorder and why the myocarditis and why a number of other things are as problematic as they are. By focusing on having the human body itself manufacture a known toxin, the spike protein is a known toxin. So by injecting a thing that turns the human body into a factory to manufacture a toxin, it would be lovely to be able to take the data from naturally occurring SARS coronavirus and at least postulate what you think the health effect is going to be. The problem is that we know that this is a computer simulation of what we think a spike protein would generalize to be, quote, a broad spectrum response to get immune response inside of the human body. The problem is we don't have an analog in nature to study. So we don't actually know what we in fact encoded when we injected that mRNA into the human body. Hmm. We have a hunch, but I don't know about you, but a hunch when you're injecting a pathogen manufacturing device into the body is kind of a dubious place to be.
How did the medical establishment get hustled into the position of supporting all this?
Very, very, very simply. Graft and corruption.
Our newest sponsor is Sage Restoration, a fine company specializing in high-quality traditional paints and materials for building preservation. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. And by the way, they sent me some complimentary refined linseed oil, one of their products. I happen to be a painter myself, an art painter, and I cooked up a batch of my usual painting medium with their product, and boy, was I pleased with that. And now a few words from our sponsor. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials. But our building history tells us that it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oil paints and resins to protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten, peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that lasts for decades, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it is our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials that have been proven over time and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit their website at sagerestoration.com. That's one word, sagerestoration.com. Sage Restoration also sponsors the Eyesore of the Month feature on the Kunstler.com website. We thought that would be a refreshing counterpoint to the typical eyesore buildings we present each month. And now back to the podcast. Well, I mean, I've been saying for years personally that medical system has just become a racketeering system, but
that's all it is.
It's a pretty awesome charge.
Well, it's not a charge when you actually have, I mean, listen, Pfizer has been paying record fines for their willful misleading of people. You know, the Purdue family, you know, did their mea culpa and said, oh, we're so sorry that people got addicted to opioids, despite the fact that they had filed patents on non-addictive formulas for opioids and then kept them from the market so that the only drugs that were available were addictive. It's kind of hard with the evidence that is, in fact, in the public record not to come to the conclusion that this is not an allegation, it's an evidence-based assertion.
Well, there are what, hundreds of thousands, maybe in the millions of actual physicians out there in the world, including the civilized countries of the world. How do they get hornswoggled into this?
It's reimbursement. This is what happens when we build, and James, I remember back to your lovely presentation when we first met in 2003, but you made a statement then which echoed a statement I have reinforced many times before and since, which is we have this insidious view of humanity where we say that people are consumers. Yeah. When you are a consumer of what is called health care, there's two problems. One, a consumer requires a persistent addictive behavior. I have to keep going back to the same thing over and over and over again. I'm not getting better. I'm getting addicted.
Mm-hmm.
And for that model to work, we build reinforcing mechanisms in our compensation schemes that say that anything that a physician is going to get paid for is a thing that gets approved through some sort of standard registry of reimbursables. In other words, 100% of the economic incentive for a physician right now is to make sure that they respond to things that live inside of the approved billable regime.
Uh-huh.
Long ago, we lost the notion that to be a physician was to care about a patient. Now, to be a physician is to manage the billable moments that you have, where you have this inventory called the patient coming through your practice called the revolving door of the casino, which is roll the dice and see if you can hit lucky numbers by having your diabetes out of control, by having your asthma uncontrolled, and by having some precancerous something. And if I have those three all come up, you know, with cherries flashing, I've hit the jackpot. This is a world which left the notion of health for the notion of reimbursable consumption.
Wow. You know, when I go to my own physician here in upstate New York, I often feel like I'm going into the Bulgarian Motor Vehicle Bureau, but the casino may actually be a better metaphor for this. There's a report that a UK naval vessel, the Queen Elizabeth, had 100 out of 700 crew members infected with COVID-19, and all were vaccinated.
Yeah.
Are these vaccinations actually worthless?
Well, it's worse than worthless. They are actually stimulating the production of pathogens. So, number one, that's a bad thing. And number two, they were never studied ever in the clinical trials for their ability to limit infection or limit transmission. The average person in America, and by the way, the average person has good standing for this because it happens to be written into law, thinks that a vaccination has something to do with community transmission or community infection. These injections had only to do with what's called a medical countermeasure to lessen the severity of symptoms. The only clinical outcome in these clinical trials was the severity of hospitalizations or the severity of symptoms, which, by the way, if you read the fine print in the trials, was made worse by the fact that the decision that you actually had COVID-19 was made by a committee, not by clinical diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So we vote whether you were sick or not. It is reminiscent of the Inquisition era. You know, is someone a witch? Well, let's go find out by voting whether they float or whether they sink. It's absolutely on the beyond the edge of ludicrous that we call this a clinical trial, because we did not measure anything that is part of the standard regime for what is required under vaccine trials. And this is the FDA's own position paper, which was updated in 2014, which said that you have to trigger an immune response, you have to show an impact on infectivity, and you have to show an impact on transmission. And neither of those outcomes were studied in any of the Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, or Johnson & Johnson trials. So the whole notion that this is even a vaccine, as I've said many times, is only being called such so that it falls under the PREP Act and so that it falls under the limitation of liability that comes from the 86 Act.
What do you make of the numbers about the adverse reactions and deaths to the vaccines?
Well, conveniently, anytime somebody sniffled or coughed at the beginning of this whole pandemic, they were assumed to have COVID. Now, if you die, if you have anaphylaxis, if you have any adverse event times hundreds of thousands of cases now, the presumption is it had nothing to do with the vaccine. even if it happened when you were getting the vaccine. The great thing, and I know this comes as an assurance to everyone listening, the great thing is the only people investigating the causes of death or the causes of morbidity in patients are the people administering the compound. So I'm sure there's no conflict of interest whatsoever in having no independent investigation at all in the actual causes of death or disability. So the good news is the people who are peddling the toxin are the ones charged with investigating whether the toxin was in fact toxic.
Do you have any idea how aggressive the spike protein is in attacking vascular tissues?
Well, we know that there has got to be something that is a confounding variable. And what does that mean? That means that not everybody has the response. Mm-hmm. So there has to be something that is part of either somebody's biology or somebody's clinical presentations of other things. And there have been, by the way, suggestions that, you know, an enormous number of people, as you probably know, are on things like ACE inhibitors or on beta blockers or on other heart medication. There's tons of people on various statin medications that have the possibility of essentially priming the vascular epithelium to have inflammation responses that we didn't have any way of anticipating or knowing until we started putting a foreign toxin into the body. What we know is that the number of cases seems to be growing, and worse than that, we know that the number of side effects seems to be worsening as we watch the trial data unfold. And, you know, the latest round, obviously, in the pediatric myocarditis cases, but now we're starting to see an enormous number of vascular problems that appear to be blood disorders and things that look a lot like autoimmune disorders. And what's going to happen is over the next several months, in the race against the clock, where, as you just saw last week, the FDA is going to accelerate their effort to approve the Pfizer vaccine so it does advance from being emergency use authorization to full approval. The race to get to the approval line seems to be currently neck and neck with the evidence that says that this thing is in fact lethal. And the question is going to be who gets to the finish line first. And the odds on favorite is Pfizer gets to the finish line, because if it gets approval, then it gets the ultimate waiver of liability. So nobody ever gets to come back and say, you knew that you were killing us.
Well, you're acquainted with Rainer Fulmich, who is a German attorney who is seeking to actually bring a case, I think, to the world court. I'm not sure against whom or exactly who the defendant he has in mind is, but he's a very serious guy, and he's not a nut. And he put out a video last week in which he said the following: "A year ago, it would have seemed crazy to say this, but now it looks like COVID-19 has been a scheme to reduce population and control the people who are left." He said this was a greater crime than anything that happened in the two world wars. And that's saying a lot.
Yeah, it is.
So how do you view that statement?
Well, let's start with the fact that the real perpetrators in this particular situation know that there is a greater event horizon, which you've talked about for at least a decade that I know of.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that too. So,
but this is a cover-up. This is a way to defer action and hopefully get enough of the population either dead or disabled so that they forget the broken promises that were made back in the New Deal. The fact of the matter is we are in a situation where the indifference to human life is not a benign neglect. This is not just a bunch of scientists out on a picnic outing seeing how far they can take their mad schemes. This is something that is in fact a necessity to deal with the fact that somewhere between 2028 and 2030, we have a much bigger problem on the horizon and that is the insolvency of our entitlement programs. And with that insolvency comes the insolvency of most people's pension and retirement plans. And if we have fewer people, we probably have less concern about that than if we have a full population expecting to buy their $6 Starbucks coffee and find out that they go to the ATM and there's nothing there. So the fact of the matter is, in addition to the human cost of what's happening right now, my deeper concern is that this is a cover for even a more heinous crime, which is the willful theft and destruction of a population, where in fact what we have is we have probably one of the best orchestrated mass casualty events to cover up what is an even larger financial fraud.
So I'd have to infer from that that you might expect a whole lot of people who were who received vaccinations to die.
There's no question that I fully anticipate that. And the reason I fully anticipate that is the data is showing that that's happening.
Hey, everybody. We're proud of our association with David McElvaney's ICA Wealth Management as a sponsor of this podcast. And I recommend you listen to the McElvaney Weekly Commentary, David's fine podcast, out every Tuesday and available at iTunes Podcasts. Gold has been on a roller coaster, but we got a clue about where it's moving later this year. Think money printing from sea to shining sea. Can you spot an inflationary trend? When dollars lose purchasing power, it's time to think about wealth preservation. It's time to think about gold. There is no better asset for building a stable foundation for your portfolio, and Vaulted is the easiest way to invest in gold. Vaulted is an online mobile web app for investing in allocated and deliverable physical gold. Buy and secure gold with ease and convenience, giving you full control over securing your financial future. Vaulted delivers the best prices every time, along with personal advising from the experts at McElvaney ICA. Join thousands of investors who have discovered these benefits for wealth preservation in an increasingly worrisome time. Visit kunstler.com/vaulted to learn more about the Vaulted program at McElvaney ICA and earn this podcast a referral point when you sign up. That's kunstler.com/vaulted, V-A-U-L-T-E-D. And now back to the show. Have you encountered by any chance the webpage by Deagle, the military analysis website, that predicted rather mysteriously, because they didn't explain it very much, that the U.S. population would run to 100 million in the year 2025. And of course, it's now about 330 million. And also that the major European nations would also show a shocking and sharp drop in population.
Well, I'm familiar with a number of the, not familiar with that site, James, but I'm familiar with a number of people who have made similar projections. And one of the things that I've worked with a few other people on is to try to alert the U.S. military. In fact, we've had some success in communicating this message, not as much as I'd like. But we have suggested that one of the most insidious problems is in this country, we prioritize injecting experimentals into our enlisted men and women. And we may very well have just rendered our entire defense of this country relatively incapacitated by preferring to get them injected first. We have may have set ourselves up for an indefensibility scenario, which I've spent a lot of time writing about, and I've written some interesting papers that have gone fairly widely through the Department of Defense on this very topic.
Well, you alluded a few minutes ago to what I think is the book that I wrote in that came out in 2005, The Long Emergency, which...
Yes, I love that book.
Why, thank you. Which describes the collapse of our techno-industrial society. One of the things that seems to me we're seeing now, you know, 15 years into this, that the process of collapse, if that's what it is, seems to throw off a lot of kind of what I would call entropic disorder.
Yeah.
Which appears to be expressed in our politics. What do you make of the seeming utter insanity of the ideas that we are entertaining in our culture right now?
Well, I think as you anticipated, and you know, I've spent a lot of time in the foresight and scenario planning world, courtesy of people like John Peterson at the Arlington Institute, who had me around, and mm-hmm. the UK foresight entities, and Singaporeans risk assessment horizon scanning, and a number of other projects that I've been involved in. One of the things that has been part and parcel of every scenario that we've laid out is this almost caricature of the bizarre and the insane, where we don't know, you know, what genders we are anymore. We don't know what ethnicities we are anymore. We manufacture that, you know, a woman can weightlift in a man's competition or vice versa. Like we're in these bizarre manufactured flashpoints of public response.
Well, I would actually go so far as to call that deliberate mind fuckery.
Oh, absolutely. I think the fuckery is afoot at great peril to civil discourse and a great peril to the rest of what we would have referred to as civilization in a nostalgic kind of way. The problem that I see unfolding is that the orchestration of the chaos makes the illusion of entropy the logical experience, only then to see that this is not entropic at all. This is very much of a planned detonation. And much like the beautiful World War II movies that you can't watch in the day or the night because they were shot in such low film, you know, if all I have is a backpack full of C4 and I've got a giant stone bridge that was built right after the Romans left Europe and I've got to blow the thing up, I have to know where to put depth charges to create the structural decay that allows for the system level collapse. And I think what we have is, whether it's the gender issue, whether it's the race issue, here in Charlottesville, we got rid of the Lewis and Clark statue because Sacagawea appears to be sitting on a rock, and that's demeaning. So we got rid of a sculpture that actually included a First Nation American, you know, actually included her in the sculpture.
Heroically.
We got rid of that because she was, God forbid, not riding the horse that she probably never rode. And so these kind of moments of sheer lunacy are done, I think, to anesthetize a population, kind of like propofol is given before you get the full knockout.
Oh, boy.
This is the haze in which we get so distracted and bothered by the annoyances that we actually just roll over and acquiesce to the real crime that's happening.
Do you have a view of what Donald Trump represented coming along when he did?
Well, you probably know this. I mean, I have had nothing but disdain for the political infrastructure of this country since the Carter-Reagan election, where, you know, Iran-Contra was clearly not a manipulation of election. You know, the fact is, and I don't know, I mean, I don't know when the hijack was complete. But what I do know is that I find it unfortunate that in our society, we actually put characters who have no character up as potential for leadership. The fact of the matter is, if we go back and we look through, whether it's Bush, whether it's, you know, Obama, whether it's Clinton, and whether it's Trump, we have people who probably had redeeming qualities at some level. But the problem is that they were compromised from the get-go. And anytime you put up someone who we know to be compromised into a position of what we call leadership, what we know is that that means that there are marionette strings that are attached to something somewhere. And if we look at where those strings attach, we find that they all seem to go back to some very common little puppet master hands. And so, you know, you look at Trump's election, and you look at the fact that, not surprisingly, Rentec, the largest quant fund in modern history, was one of the largest donors. And you ask yourself, well, why would a quant fund manager be so obsessed about having Donald Trump come into office? And then you go back and you look at what was going on with them, and you find out that what they were trying to do is deal with the fact that the Treasury was starting to realize that maybe the reason why some of their trading was so profitable is they were probably bending or breaking a bunch of tax laws. When financial interests, who in fact hijack the political system and have hijacked the political system for as long as it's been around, but when financial interests have the ability not only to hijack the system, but also put up compromised characters into positions of leadership, I think the illusion of democracy is nothing more than a diaphanous veil for what is clearly the self-serving interests of the check writers. And in this particular case, we are in a position where, whether it was Donald Trump or not, the fact is that a compromised position of alleged leadership is one of the most dangerous things that a democratic society could ever hope for.
And yet Mr. Trump somehow seems to have galvanized what looks like a real opposition to this kind of gaming, however we call it. So that, it's developed a life of its own.
Yeah. And listen, I mean, I would give him a ton of credit for a couple things. First of all, his audacity provided a cover for those individuals who have always wanted to say the audacious, but have always felt restrained from doing so. And that's a huge service to a frustrated population. If you see somebody who is brash, brazen, and even rude, and you have had those thoughts, but you have never felt safe to express them, you get a lot of air cover from a person who's willing to just say it. Yeah. And I think that there was a cathartic value that he provided to an enormous number of people who were frustrated by the political correct excesses of what's unfolded over the last decade and a half. So I think that he provided a pretty galvanizing service there. And I think he also did a wonderful job of lampooning what we have historically seen as the kind of august structures of the political establishment. I think by being the character he was, and the character he remains, by the way, I think he does a wonderful job of showing that the emperor of representational democracy has no clothes. So I think that he's done some things that are actually quite beneficial in the long arc of the public discourse and critique of democracy. I think that the way in which he did it was, in fact, polarizing to a pathologic extreme. Mm-hmm. And the likelihood that we are going to see a functional response in the relatively near future is, I think, a less than zero probability.
Well, would you not say that Joe Biden is an even more improbable replacement for Donald Trump? You know, this 45-year veteran of American politics who was regarded as rather stupid, never accomplished anything in the Senate, and is clearly not fully functional now. Is he a completely improbable figure? And who is running him? Who do you think is running him?
Well, I think that the same people, oddly enough, that were running Trump. I think that if we go back and look at who has benefited from the expansion of this nation state in chaos, what we see is the corporatocracy of companies like Palantir, companies like Amazon, companies like the established both defense and pharmaceutical complex. And if we look at the consolidation of all of those interests, the largest beneficiaries of all of those are the BlackRocks and the State Streets and the Vanguards and the Bank of America, Merrill Lynch's and others. At the end of the day, this is in fact a financial coup on the nation state being played out in the illusory world of still this kind of macabre theater of what we think of as the political sphere. But the political sphere has been contaminated so thoroughly that the judiciary is sitting on its hands doing nothing, and they have been for a long time. I mean, listen, the fact that the Justice Department is investigating antitrust allegations against Google. I mean, just play this out. Mm-hmm. Where a few years ago at the Cannes Ad Week, which is the largest film festival for advertisers in the world, where they all get together and have these self-congratulatory masturbation fests for their advertising and seduction campaigns that control the minds of the world's population. Google, at the Cannes Ad Week, sponsored events where, in total contempt for their clients, they actually sponsored events called Why Advertisers Hate Google. Google sponsored it. And at those events, what was revealed was that the largest advertising agencies, the Omnicoms, the Chiat Days, the IPGs, and others, actually fix ad campaign language so that their corporate client advertisers have to pay Google more for search engine optimization. Now, that got the attention of European antitrust regulators, and instantaneously they knew that they had a case. But guess what? Like in Europe, the U.S. Justice Department is chasing its tail, saying, "Ooh, we think we're going to go after big tech," and big tech has priced it into their cost of doing business. The fact of the matter is they'll pay a fine, they'll settle, and nothing will change. But the fact is that we have a world in which the cost of criminal behavior is now a cost of doing business.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually factored into the price that the customer is paying. So we are paying a premium because the companies know they are breaking the law. They will one day have to pay a public fine, and it'll be the $1 billion largest fine ever in human history. And guess what they'll do the next day? More of the same.
Since we're talking about finance, I really feel like I have to ask you this question. As I see it, capitalism has a big problem with capital. And we're so deeply in debt now that there's practically no probability that most of it will ever be paid back.
Correct.
Or possibly even serviced, that is the interest paid. Does that not imply that we face a deep impaired capital formation problem?
Yeah.
I mean, after all, debt as a financial instrument can only work if it's a two-way street, if there's some plausible expectation that the money borrowed will be paid back. So we seem to be in a terrible quandary here.
Yeah, and I think we made it worse by something. And I'm going to geek out for a moment just because I haven't geeked out enough. And I'm looking at okay. A picture of you in a bow tie, so I'm going to go ahead and geek out. There's two problems, Jim. One, which is a huge, huge technical problem. The way our finance, our money is supposed to work is a thing called fractional reserve, where we essentially create monetary units by having banks issue things like mortgages and credit and all kinds of other things. And to do that, a bank has to have what's called reserve capital, which is 8 to 10 cents on the dollar. And then they go out and they create loans, and those loans have monetary value, but they have monetary value because, like a mortgage, they'll be paid over 30 years. So you're exactly right that over a period of time, what starts off as ephemeral fractional money becomes, over a period of time, as those mortgages or credits are being serviced, it becomes money over time. Fast forward to what happened over the last 20 months, and what we have is a problem where the U.S. government decided to start printing dollars as dollars. So we have a mix in our currency economy right now of fiat dollars that started off at par. They were a dollar when they were issued, and we have the fractional reserve dollars that are 8-cent dollars. And what we've done is we've now merged those two worlds together, which means that the debt that we issued, and I mean, you know, sovereign debt, treasuries, those mm-hmm. kinds of things, the debt we issued will not be repayable in the currency in which it was issued, because mm-hmm. we've actually changed the currency. Now, in a world where we built systems, as you quite correctly implied, we built systems that were largely based on refinancing things. So we never meant to pay them off. We actually meant to kick the can down the road and refinance this and refinance that. And we were conditioned to do that after 9/11, where we were supposed to take out second mortgages and third mortgages to pay off credit cards and use our houses as ATMs and all that kind of nonsense. The fact of the matter is the reasonable expectation of repayment has gone to zero. Worse than that, the currency with which we would make the repayment has now no longer been the currency in which we originated the credit in the first place. So we've got two problems, not one. What that means is that in 2000 and somewhere between 2028 and 2030, we all have to pay the price for the illusion, because the biggest buyer of those funny money instruments has been the public entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and defined benefit programs and pensions. Now, we already know that pensions and defined benefit programs have been the kitty against which states and municipalities have borrowed money for a very long time. The problem is when they actually have to perform, which is the fiduciary obligation of anybody who's in a fixed income investment stewardship role, when they have to perform, they are going to be using funny money to repay an illusion that they do not have the liquidity to repay. And this goes back to the core of the issue I've been banging the drum on since 2001, which is we have an illiquid future because we do not have a production-oriented economy.
Yeah, finance is now divorced from the on-the-ground production of things of value.
Yeah.
But what you're describing is really a system that's quite broken.
And the last chance we had actuarially, meaning using kind of the compounding models that we were all supposedly taught somewhere in math class once upon a time, the compounding model broke in 2011. Our last chance to fix this was 2011. So the great news is we're a decade over the edge of the cliff.
Uh-huh. I can easily imagine a set of converging circumstances that are going to push us over the cliff in pretty short order.
Yep.
Starting with, the political disorder that will be arising out of these election audits.
Yeah.
That are really seriously going to compromise Joe Biden's legitimacy and indeed the entire government, the precarious fragility of the markets and the banks. And it's not hard to see those two things coming together at the end of the summer and early fall.
Yeah. And I think that the point for conversations like this is to remind people that we have lived through these paroxysmal kind of moments in the past. The bad news is it sucks when you're living in them. And the good news is that if you kind of hold your head down and not lose, you know, your cool, you do make it through. But it is something that you've been talking about as long as I've been talking about this, which is the fact is we are going to have to adjust to a significantly reduced set of expectations on our consume everything without consideration worldview, because the fact of the matter is that's not going to be available to us. Forget whether it's morally or socially or ethically appropriate. It has nothing to even do with that. It literally will not be available to us.
Yeah, I'd go even a little bit further and say, personally, I don't expect that we're going to be living in a higher tech age. I expect a deep and long economic contraction that will, in effect, be a major time out from what we have called progress.
Oh, no question. And I think that We're already seeing the beginnings of that. We're seeing supply chain disruptions where enormous numbers of things that we once thought we could count on are simply not available anymore. You know, little tiny bellwethers are, go to any store, go to any, you know, restaurant, go to anywhere and look at what's happening with the Asian supplied food. And it turns out that we're already seeing transportation, infrastructure, delivery failures. We're starting to see backlogs. We're starting to see resource constraints. And the fact of the matter is, we're just at the beginning of what I agree with you to be a relatively long period of time where I think we're going to have some real austerity. And I would remind people that, you know, we have this ridiculous story of 1929, and we call it the Great Depression, but people don't pay attention to the fact that the real economic hardship was the Dust Bowl, and that lasted for 7 years. Right? It wasn't a 1929 event. We have these grainy newsreel images of people walking in top hats in New York, and we go, oh, that was a terrible year. But the fact of the matter is, 1929 gave rise to 7 years of the Dust Bowl. That gave rise to some of the greatest austerity this country has faced. And in many respects, it required events leading to the Second World War to stimulate the economy out of what was in fact a death spiral in 1935.
Well, I have one final question for you. And that is, can you imagine that there might actually be a legal reckoning over COVID-19, some kind of a momentous legal reckoning? And I have to attach this to another thing, which has been a pet peeve of mine, which is, I'm not sure that can happen unless we get some legal action on the Russia collusion hoax and all of the misbehavior, the institutional misbehavior that went on with that. And I'm sorry that that's a kind of a hybrid chimerical question, but there you have it.
No, I think so. So let's treat it, though, for what it actually is. Remember that if there is a theater of cover stories run as distractions on a fundamental story, the fundamental story is one where I would put the odds of a genuine reckoning at near zero. Because the real reckoning is that the public stewards that were entrusted with the public trust, and by that I mean the long-dated asset managers, the pension managers, the you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid administrators, those people.
Basically, the fiduciaries.
Retire in the Hamptons, and they are not going to give a shit about the fact that Anthony Fauci or Bill Barr or anybody else takes the fall. Mm-hmm. So the real perpetrators, because the public doesn't think enough to realize that even the people we think of as public enemies are in fact nothing more than stooges being manipulated by a third party. And the third party happens to be the ones conveniently masking their identities to the point where the public doesn't even know they exist. I mean, this is no different, James, than when we had the Peugeot Commission in 1911. And the public today doesn't even remember that in 1911, we the people demanded accountability for the convergence of interlocking business interests with banks, insurance, life insurance companies, and railroad and industrial magnates. We the people held hearings in Congress to find out whether or not the government had been bought. And we concluded in 1911 in the Peugeot Committee report that it in fact had been bought, which gave rise to a whole bunch of other investigations, the Anderson Commission, a bunch of others. The fact of the matter is, we today are less astute about the interlocking nature of our society and its systems than we were 100 years ago. So the likelihood we get real justice for the real perpetrators, I'd put it next to zero. Now, the good news, if people like to have, you know, public executions in the town square, is when the wheels fall off the financial bus, which they will in the next few years, we are going to need to have public humiliations and public repercussions. And so if Fauci survives into his mid to late 80s, I think we could expect to see a perp walk for somebody like him. I think we could see a perp walk for some of the actors in this current theater. And I think we could see a perp walk for some of the people who trumped up all of the allegations of foreign interference, while in fact the interference is happening here domestically. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that the genuine justice, which is in fact needing to be directed at the financial institutions who are running the show, I think they will die comfortably in their fluffy pillow beds and will know that they anonymously gamed the system and benefited from that gaming. And I doubt that the public will ever have the appetite to actually inform itself enough to hold it accountable.
Well, we'll probably be too busy chasing down squirrels to roast over our campfires. And with that, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been a great conversation.
James, it's an honor to reconnect with you, and I'm delighted that we can have this conversation now, because I've got a bunch of squirrels in my forest, and you're always welcome.
Thank you. Would you tell the listeners how they can see some of your videos on your personal website and network? And
Certainly. I can be found at davidmartin.world. I'm on social media at David Martin World in all kinds of different formats. And my daily show is at activatehumanity.com.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'm looking forward to seeing you again at some time. And we will ride again.
Very good.